Bobby Mayfield on this. Crispy $100 bills. Tucked in my Versace pocket, just got a bird in. Finna let my workers rock it. Mumble phone ringing while I'm dreaming about my digital scale. On my mind all the time, in the meanwhile getting bail. Clientele scattered in all four directions. Too many schools be hating, so I got that calico for protection. Flexing nuts on my cup, we result in the wig split. 211, 187, that's what you busters get. Hitting suckers up, cause I'm OG affiliated. Excelling in this game, and I know you traitors hate it. That thug like no love, like get mugged.
Welcome back to this, the fourth and final episode of our season devoted to the story of Memphis rap. We hope that you are enjoying the box out there and listening to it and really appreciating these artists that are finally getting the due that they deserve and getting archived in this way by having their stuff put on vinyl. We're really proud of this box. It's our first rap-oriented box, and doing these kind of projects is what makes working at VMP so life-affirming, that we get to honor these records that did not get the due that they deserved in the first place, and getting to present them in the way that they maybe always should have been presented. This episode is devoted to Tory's interview with Little Said. He sat down with Little Said to talk primarily about Playing by the Rules, the only full-length album Little Said ever did on his own as a solo artist. But this conversation kind of goes everywhere. They talk about his group, R.A.N. He talks about how they almost ended up on Rap-A-Lot Records from Houston. They talk about how he turned down beats from a pre-fame Little John. The fact that he didn't know that he was famous worldwide at all until much later into his career. We also hear about how his life completely changed after a YouTube video he made led to him being a teacher now in Memphis. So without further ado, here's Tory and Little Said.
Ain't no need to snitch. I'm playing this game by the rules, trick. I'm playing this game by the rules. I'm playing this.
How old were you? You said you started hustling when you were like 14. Were your parents like, had they given up trying to control you, or you were just too wild?
Nah, at that time, I was living in Glenview. But first, I was living with Glenview, and some guys that I was just watching what they were doing, and it was like they put me in. And my daddy had recently went to L.A. Like I told you, started staying in California. And so I was living with my aunts in Glenview because I still wanted to be over there a lot. And so I still was going over there when my dad moved. I still was going to Glenview. And that's where I started it, in Glenview. And then when I came to Orange Mound, I saw how they were doing it. I'm like, hold on, I need to be doing it in Orange Mound. Because what I'm making, I could make $200 off of what they only making $100 off this. I'm like, hold up. So it was more money on Orange Mound. So I was like, Orange Mound, I started hanging on Orange Mound more when I started selling rocks and stuff. I started selling on Orange Mound more because it was more money than it. And it wasn't about them control. It was a lot went on. Like at that time, I was living with my aunts, and it was more than one of my uncles, and they got on drugs. My grandmama, the same house we go to right now, the same house my daddy stayed in. My grandmama, my daddy went to California. My grandmama went to Mississippi with my granddaddy, so she ain't come back for a while, just back and forth. So all my aunts, they was the coolest aunts in the world, most lovable people in the world, take care of us, really take care of us. But they came up in that era, that crack era, like that 80s crack era, and they got caught up being hip and cool, and all of them got on crack. So some of the dope dealers and stuff, they used to come over there, sell them dope, hang out, And so, and that's really what made me like, man, they coming over here making money out of my folks. You know what I'm saying? And so I started hanging outside the house. Because then I noticed all the people that, all the adults in that era, around that time, was messing with it. So it was so easy. Like, I just go outside. They didn't know what I was doing. But when they did find out, they, my auntie Faith, may she rest in peace. She died about 2 years ago. She was like, but all of them had got off drugs. They were nurses. All of them doing good. They came up and said, my aunt, she died. But they all got off drugs and started back being wonderful people. But they were still wonderful people while they was on drugs, though. But they caught themselves cracking down on me one day. They said I had a beeper. Now, back then, we had the beepers. Yeah. And the beeper went off. And my auntie Faye gonna say, it sounded like it was a white guy. He said he wanted a 20. But the beeper wasn't even no... I had got the beeper from somebody, and I didn't even know how to work the beeper, none. But back then, the first beepers would talk.
Like, oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, like you called a number, and they go, leave your message, beep. Then you said, well, look, this said, man, call me at so. So when I hang up, when it beep you, you push it, and what I just said would be on your beeper. Mm-hmm. You can hear my message.
Okay.
That's how the first beepers was. They didn't have the number that come up.
Oh.
The first beeper had the voice.
I didn't know
that. And it was mostly work people, like FedEx and people like, they were in doctors and stuff.
Yeah,
no, they had
doctors.
Them first.
Yeah.
And so, but the man said something, but he wasn't buying no drugs, because I got to be from. And so they searched me, and they found some rocks, and I'm sure they probably used them, because they was on it at the time. But they found some rocks, and I started having a tug of war with them, and I ended up going back to Orange Mountain with my mama for good. You know, I ended up going for good because they was on drugs and stuff. So I went over there with my mama. My mama never touched nothing. And so I went back with my mama, and that's when I really started, you know, I got the car, and I was got with the big dope boys over there in Orange Mountain. You know, and it was all she wrote.
It must have been hard to see your family fucked up on drugs.
Especially if you looked up to them and they showed you so much love, like I said, they still was good people. You know, they still, but it just was different, you know, because they spend their time in the back room,
mm-hmm.
come out here once in a while, but they want just like the same, because if they used to take us everywhere, we had fun, and that ain't going nowhere. We just, you know, we never went hungry we still was the same, but they just weren't spending the time and like, going places and stuff like we used to. But we never was raggedy, hungry, lights out, none of that. It wasn't none of that. Cause my aunts, like I said, they was nurses. So they still went to work every day.
Damn.
You know, they still paid their bills, you know, but they just was on drugs and locked in the back room and come out there and watch, what y'all doing? All right, you know what I'm saying? And then they still will whoop your butt if you made bad grades. They expected the most out of us.
So you start hustling at 14. When did you start rapping?
I started rapping.
So you were born in 73, so you started rapping in 91.
Mm-hmm.
So you were 18.
You know what? I might have started rapping a little earlier, because probably about 90.
Is that... So then... You formed a group?
Huh?
Is that when you formed R.A.N.?
Yep.
Who are the other members of that group?
First, it started off with me, Lil' Seal, and Lil' Reggie. And then Reggie really was like, he was caught up so much in the dope, selling drugs and all that. He didn't really have time. He just was playing around.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't just take it serious. He just was doing something. But me and Seal wanted to go far with it. We want to go on and beat it. So Reggie stopped doing it with us. So it just was me and Seal after that. So okay. When we did the R.A.N. Gotta Be Lyrical album, the one I was telling you about,
mm-hmm.
When we did that album, it was just me and Seal. But when we did a song called Quit Fucking With The R.A.N. Quit Fucking With The R.A.N. It's on, the first one we did is on Squeaky Volume, I think 4. No, I think it's 7. Speak about, it's a slower. That's chapter 1. Then we did another one called chapter 2. We did it at Squeaky House. MJG made the beat. And Squeaker recorded it. And I gave the song to DJ Paul, though, to put on Volume 14. Mm-hmm. DJ Paul Volume 14. The first song on there, that's me. That's R.A.N.
Okay.
The first song on DJ Paul Volume 14. Then I gave him, I'm on DJ Paul Volume 14, 15, and 16 as R.A.N. And I'm on Squeaky, like three or four of his volumes as R.A.N. But I did, but when I went solo and started just being Lil Sid, I put out an album called Playing by the Rules, which the one that y'all, that
yeah.
Playing by the Rules. And I put out 211 album too. Mm-hmm. When I started my label, I put out 211 Ghetto Gangsta album.
Yeah.
Y'all need to get that too. But it is Gangsta Gangsta. We actually recorded them songs around the same time. We recorded them, the songs in the 90s. And we didn't release them to like, I think I brought that album like out in 01 or 2000 or 01, one of them. But we did those songs in the 90s though.
Mm-hmm.
We did none of those songs in the 2000s. We just were doing songs. We had so many songs. Like, you know what? We need to put these songs together and put out an album. 211 had just got out of jail. So I got a photo shoot, bought them some clothes, did this, 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 and you know, we just put the song, we already had the songs. And I had Ice White Records. I had a lot of other stuff I did too, but it didn't ever get released because that's why we're trying to tell like the youngsters I know now that's trying to be in the music business, you got to choose, because it's like, if you're a gangster, you can't be a gangster and be in the music business. It seemed like you can, but you really can't.
No.
Because if you be a true gangster, see them dudes in the movie ain't no true gangsters, because they'll be already the ones that's true gangsters in jail. You either gonna go to jail or get killed. You're not gonna be going around shooting, having shootouts and all this stuff, and then go to do a show at FedEx Forum. It ain't gonna happen. You gonna, even if somebody with you, once your name blow up, even if somebody with you get into something, they gonna say you, because you got the name.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you got to, if you're serious about being in the music business and you're a gangster, you got to stay away from everybody so you won't get into nothing. You got to lay low. You can't be both. These guys, I know that for sure. You ain't been, so me, I was back and forth in and out of jail because I was the coolest guy in the world. But people were so jealous of the stuff I was having and what I was doing. I always looked so young and little for my age. They wanted to come like they gonna do something to me or take something from me, or, and I always clicked out and they called the police, but they was bothering me, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
People had always put charges on me, like they'll start stuff with me and then call the police when I click or whatever. So I was back and forth in jail, like ups and downs, losing everything, get out, come back, try to build it back up. And
what years was that? Like
that was like from always, like I was going to jail like every, but I never did no real time, but I had to get lawyers, make bonds,
mm-hmm.
and now I can't move and groove like I really want to. It was a major effect. Then I had to hustle more now because I got to pay these lawyers, I got to do this. There's less money I can put into the music business.
Mm-hmm.
And I could have came out with Suave House Records.
Really?
I don't want to hook them up. A-Ball, MJG, all the Memphis rappers, I'd have hooked them up with T-Money Draper. That was with Swag.
Yeah,
House, right?
Yeah.
And
How did you know Tony Draper?
Tony Draper and my brother-in-law was like friends.
Okay.
Tim Woods. That's because he's a famous T. Woods. He in the feds right now. But he was the one with the real money. But
from Hustler?
Me, Tony, and Tim was riding one day, and Tony Draper showed me a tape of a group from New Orleans. I don't remember the name, but I know they was Mr. Big. He called himself Mr. Big, and he was like, "Listen to this." And he let me hear it, and he's like, "You like it?" I was like, "Nah, it's kind of corny." And so he was like, "I said, you want some?" He was like, "Well, I got this record label, Swag House. I'm trying to do this. I'm trying to do that. I used to work with rap a lot."
Mm-hmm.
He showed me some pictures with him and Lil J, him and Scarface. He said he used to be working for Rap-A-Lot. So I was like, "Man, you want some real rappers?" Alright, I took him over Squeaky House, cause there were all the rappers just hanging out.
Mm-hmm.
Took him over Squeaky House, and that's the first time Tony Draper talked to Squeaky, talked to A-Ball, and talked to
Wild.
And so I took Skinny wasn't over there that day, But I kept telling him about Skinny. So I took Skinny in 211 to Tony Draper hotel room. And 8-Ball, so by that time, they had already hooked up with 8-Ball. And 8-Ball was in the room. And then we went to I started taking them to Texas, to Houston, Texas. They had a spot where they were doing the music in Texas, in the condo. So we were back and forth to Houston, Texas. And Tony Draper told me that he wanted to bring out the album, the R.A.N. album. But I ain't gonna go into like all what went up with fire at that time, but
I mean, and Swell House was just like a tiny bullshit little label he was trying to start
at the time, and then he wanted me to give him some money too, like, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Well, I'm just gonna go on, keep it real. He told me to give him $4,000, and when he get through doing A-Ball and stuff, he gonna do my album. He gonna put my album out. And at the same time, he was like, and I'm gonna get A-Ball to write you some lyrics. And I'm said, but I need some help out, cause I already was giving him money. You know what I'm saying? I already was giving him money before this. That's why he knew okay. He could ask me. So I already like doing little stuff for him. He's my friend, and he needed, and he was trying to do it. I was just supporting. You know, I was getting money. And I wasn't getting on thousands and stuff, but I was getting him 400 here, 200 there. Mm-hmm. Pick him up from the airport. Do this. Do that little stuff. You know. And so he had me for $4,000. Then I had talked to Tim. Him and Tim was having to fall out about some stuff. And so Tim, my brother-in-law, I met Drew through him.
Yeah.
And then Tim saying he not putting no more money in, and some money came up missing and this and this. So why would I give him some money? So I was like, nah, you know what? I'm gonna take that $4,000 and go to Atlanta. And so I went to Atlanta, and I really wanted to be with Rap-A-Lot. You know, we went R.A.N. with Rap-A-Lot back then, because they were like the gangster of the gangsters.
Yeah.
So I was like...
I mean, also, they were the only real label in the South, more or less.
And we wanted to be with Rap-A-Lot when we was on there. If you listen to the R.A.N., you'd be like, okay, I see you now. Because it's like on some gangster nip type.
Okay.
Gangster like Killer, Crazy. And it would have fit right in at that time with Rap-A-Lot. So once we got there, my cousin, he's a music attorney. He's an entertainment attorney. And
big fucking family.
Yeah. His name Ronald Wilson. And he's the CEO of Lollapalooza. You remember Lollapalooza?
Lollapalooza?
He's the CEO. Now, a lot of people think Jamie Foxx is, because Jamie Foxx used to host it. And Marcus King is Jamie Foxx's manager. And my cousin was roommates in college.
Oh, man.
And so I used to help him with Lollapalooza. I used to wear the staff, so I used to pick the stars up from the airport and in the limousines and get their bags and put them in the van while we trail the limousine, all this stuff, get their rooms. And I used to help with it. But Jamie Foxx used to host it. But my cousin, if you looked in the fine print, Ronald Wilson is the he was like, I can get you a meeting with Rap-A-Lot. But he was like, but man, really though, you can do the same stuff like what Rap-A-Lot gonna do. You can do it. You'll be your own boss. And yeah, I was like, so he took me to Lil Jon. Lil Jon let me hear some beats. I turned them down. I turned Lil Jon. Back then though, it was like
in the 90s.
Yeah, early 90s. So it was like 93.
Okay. Yeah, so it was like more like Atlanta bass shit, huh?
He let me hear some beats sound like Luke Skywalker on rap off of it. And I was like, nah. He's like,
I'm selling dope.
It was Lil Jon. Yeah. So I was like, nah, I want them beats. So he took me to several people, and he took me to this guy named Flash. And I was like, he let me hear some stuff. I was like, okay. So I wanted to do it with Flash. And that's who ended up producing the whole album. The R.A.N. album, Flash.
Okay.
I talked to him the other day. And I ended up letting Flash do it. And I paid for everything and got it pressed, got it everything. And it actually, we were the first, other than, Gangsta Pad, of course. But around that time, everybody that was doing music, we was the first one to come, with a professional tape that sounded professional in the real studio.
This episode of the Memphis Rap Anthology Podcast is brought to you by the VMP Discord server. Looking for a place to interact with other VMP members and with VMP staffers? Want to stay up to date with what's happening in the store and in Record of the Month? Want to debate about which Essentials release is the best ever? Head to the VMP Discord. Anyone can sign up at discord.gg/vinylmeetplease. Every quarter, our staff does an AMA that's private to Discord members, and you can ask VMP whatever you'd like, in real time. Sign up now at discord.gg/vinylmeetplease. And now, back to the show. Satan holds red bones in the back seat. Now peek me as I cruise down the damn street. As I drop off a hole on every block, they better have my damn cash. So you did the RIM project.
What happened to Lil Sil?
He's still around, but he mostly started doing stuff with Squeaky.
Okay.
When I started doing my solo stuff, he was doing some solo stuff, but he started doing it with Squeaky.
So you got with Flash, and he basically went with Squeaky, and that's like...
Nah, when I did with Flash, he was with me.
Okay.
We did R.A.N. with Flash.
Okay.
After R.A.N., he started doing stuff with Squeaky, and I started doing stuff with... instead of Payroll Records, when I started with R.A.N., I started Icy White Records.
Okay.
And then I started doing solo Lil Sid, 211. I had an album called this girl called that I was doing some stuff with. I had a lot of groups. I had this group called Ghetto Natives. I was just doing all kind of stuff, and all the stuff was in that box.
No.
But I was so sick. That's what I'm telling you. You can't be no gangster and end up going to jail and lose all this stuff and come, because a lot of great ones, like we used to say, man, dude, what's the truth? He end up in jail. Like, these folks that been going 30 years talking about they killers and been killing people and selling dope and all this for 30 years, and they still rapping about it, they lying.
211's in prison right now, huh?
Because he in the streets for real. If you in the streets for real, you going to jail. If you been in the streets and now you got to out and you can do music and you can rap about whatever and you got to leave that stuff alone.
So how did you promote Playing by the Rules?
I got thousands of posters and stickers, and I went everywhere. I did the footwork. Like, I went to every city, every state that I could, and then I Selecto promoted it a little bit too.
Mm-hmm.
James Alexander with the Barcades,
yeah,
he promoted it a little bit, and but mostly I did most of the footwork. I did it myself, but they did. You know, they slick. I think they were sending overseas back then, too.
Yeah, I know. I've heard that they were, like, yeah, selling shit overseas and weren't counting it toward your sales.
And so, like, we thought we were local. And then, like, when the internet and the social media came, we get people from all over the world, like, literally all over the world. Man, I'm a big fan. I grew up on your music. You grew up on it? How old are you? So they saying, like, when it came out, we thought we was just local, or like maybe in like a few places, Mid-South, regional. And we were worldwide, and we didn't know it. And like, I got a store right now that for the past 10 years, every once in a while, they'll check with me. For that, they want their R.A.N. They in Tokyo.
Oh, yeah. The Japanese are obsessive.
Mom, somebody tell me, we'll pay you whatever. We want any of your old stuff. I didn't know whether it was a scam or whatever, but... But they really want their R.A.N. They said that they would consider trying to get something else, but they want their R.A.N. Yep.
Was Playing by the Rules your last solo tape? Why'd you stop after that?
Trouble. And then never completing projects, or like if I do complete it, something happened, or, you know, it's street life. You know, there's a lot come with it, and it's real in Memphis. It's real, so your trouble is just like, you got to stay out the way. And I trouble made me, I did a lot of stuff with Give Me Some, like Skin and stuff too. Like, I did a lot. And I was producing a lot of other people, like a lot of stuff that never come out. But I had a lot of artists. I was spending like a lot of time doing their stuff. I started making beats and producing other people. And their stuff never came out either. And so... There's a lot of, really, if you never do nothing with it, really like a lot of waste of time, really. Well, I guess we just stayed out the way, but...
Damn. So, yeah, your last album came out when you were 97, so you're 24?
Yep.
It's crazy. I mean, that's the same with a lot of other Memphis guys, is like, you record from the time you're like, you know, a teenager into your early 20s, and then
after that, it's like the real ones that really about their life getting caught up.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that turned to business, man, some of them probably are really the ones that about their life went to jail. The ones that just was rapping are still out there.
How'd you end up a teacher?
Man, God just did a lot of things in my life. I wanted to do something different. So I started filming. And my daughter, she wanted to rap. So I had a studio at the house. And I wrote her a song about the school. Mm-hmm. And I went to the school and I got a little B-roll around the school. Then they had a talent show and she did the song in the talent show. So I filmed her doing the song in the talent show.
Mm-hmm.
Filmed the principal when she don't know I'm looking. Filmed the teachers dancing. And so I made a video out of it and she put it on her YouTube page.
When was this?
And this was like, this been about 10 years ago.
Okay.
She put it on her YouTube page and everybody started like playing it So they had a job, a building engineer job that came open, and somebody recommended me to get the building engineer job at the same school that I had already put the video out. So I applied for the building engineer job. When I went, the principal found out who I was, and I like, oh, this is the guy that did the video. She's like, I want you to teach the kids how to do video, like to do this, work the cameras, and I'm like, mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So first I started off as the building engineer. But
what's a building engineer?
Like doing like quick fix stuff, like you know, like not nothing major, like, but you over the building, like if it's something I don't, say I need an electrician, I'm calling the electrician, showing where it's at, they fix it. I'm calling plumbers, this is something simple I can fix or whatever, or you know, let's make sure that then supervise no custodial team, make sure they doing what they gotta do, making their schedules, doing their time, and you know, stuff like that. So at the end of the day, for the last hour of school, I had a class. She gave me a classroom. So I took all my equipment and set up the classroom. I had a reel, and I had the monitors and the green screen, the lights, cameras. And so I started doing the class, but it was only an hour a day.
Mm-hmm.
But we started doing so much, and we were doing little short films and commercials. And we had like the school news. Like, actually, like, when you watch the news, I had them doing it like actual news. And so all the other schools started seeing what we was doing, so they, in HR, saw what we was doing, and the people who own the school saw what we was doing, and they was like, we need to be doing this full time. So they told me I couldn't be the building engineer no more. They wanted me to do a teacher full time. And so, yes, so that's how it happened. And I had thousands of students, like, to be in my class, and I built like hundreds of relationships, and I met hundreds of other teachers, and it just changed my whole life, really. And I just started doing videos, and I started doing music videos, and I used my daughter at first. That was my first guinea pig. Well, I tried all my stuff with her.
Is that like the first? Is that you're just like self-taught with that stuff?
Yep.
Huh.
Yep. Pretty much. Sometimes, and I say God, because sometimes I would be like, I'd be asleep. It'd be 3 or 4 in the morning. I'd be dreaming that I'm editing something. Then I wake up out of my dream, like, and I do what I dreamed, and that worked. I have been trying to do something and got stuck on it. I'm like, man, I'm gonna leave this stuff alone. I go to bed and I dream that I was just editing that same stuff that I was just editing. But while I was getting stuck at, I was doing it, and it was no problem. And I went back to it and did what I just dreamed, and it worked. So that's why I had to put God in, because I know to put that in my dreams, and I can do it in my dreams that I couldn't do for real. It got to be the higher power. It had to be independent in it. So that's why a lot of people ask me, how did I learn film? And I always say God.
Did you get a college degree?
Nope.
You got a high school degree? Damn.
Straight from the street, with a record. And I know how to carry myself. I know how to talk. I'm a good guy. But if you look at my records, you'd be like, I don't know what this dude here. But if you read the affidavit to every last one of my cases or charges, if you read the affidavit, you'd be like, oh, shit. it always like some, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. That I could have got out of it, really. But
do you regret the period of your life, the like hustling period?
Not really. I wish I could have been smarter with it, like. But the reason I don't regret it is because by me being in the school system, I get a lot of chances to correct students especially being in the middle school, I see a lot of boys and girls that want to go like in a certain direction where you could see them going. Mm-hmm. And they don't respect teachers. It's like, you're a teacher, what you know about the streets, about their life? But see, with me, they couldn't say that because I can come say something. They want to pay attention because they know. They know that I'm just women, you know, rappers. Because I have like rappers come up to the school, talk to them, come to the pep rallies. They know I used to rap or still rap. Or they know I do videos. They know I'm from the streets. They know all that about me. So they look at me totally different and respect me totally different than they do like just a normal teacher. I don't care if you have a doctorate degree or whatever. They don't want to hear that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. They'll come to me. And so they'll listen to me. So I can give them some real life. I use the class to draw them to me, but before we do any project, I always have life skills first. And I tell them about my experiences. I tell them how I got in trouble. I tell them how different people that I know got on drugs and how it started off. It was hip and cool. Everybody want to do this and that because it was hip and cool. But then that's how they got strung out. And this, you know, I can break. And they would listen to me because they know I actually been there. Mm-hmm. So that's the only reason why I don't regret, you know, me being in it, because I can use it as a part of my testimony, and because I want to reach kids. I want to be that voice that I had a voice, but it was the same way like them. The people that would tell me, you know me, what the streets are going to do to me, one in the streets. Mm-hmm. Now, my cousin, a lawyer, what did you know about the streets? Man, I'm going to get this money. I'll be back. But he knew, and his wife knew, my aunt knew, they knew. But coming from them, nobody from the streets that got out didn't tell me that. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And so I want to catch them while they're young. They're still in school. They got a chance. And so I don't regret it for that reason, that I can use that as leverage to, like, on the kids when I talk to them. Mm-hmm. And I can tell them real life stuff. Like, whatever they going, ain't nothing that they doing new. Whatever they doing, I can get them a story that I don't have to make up, a whole story about that same thing you doing and what's going to end up happening because this happened to me, or this happened to this person I know, or this, or mostly me, but some of the stuff I can bring up other people, and I was there, and so I don't regret it for that reason. Watch the groupie ass bitches about to break they fucking neck. Movie jet across the set with them gold things flicking. My nigga 211 on my side puffin' chicken. This a known fact, Lissette a big ball of G. Identifying new player haters like caller ID. I know Big D boys in and out of town. Is that the same little nigga from Orange Mound? Yeah, bitch, I'm still rapping. You hoes keep on capping. We gon' keep on at this shit until something happens. In the meanwhile, I'ma get a bird and go and get what I deserve. Squeak and dump beat to the motherfucking curb. Stacking cheese up in the M-Town, then bail to the...
This season of the VMP Anthology Podcast is hosted and executive produced by Andrew Winnestorfer. All interviews were conducted by Tori McAdams, who is a producer on this box and wrote the listening notes booklet as well. This season is produced and edited by Sydney Berlinger. A special thanks to Tori for doing the interviews and for all of our guests for sitting for them. And a special thanks to our friends over at Now Again Records for spearheading this box and for partnering with us on it. And before we go, a reminder, listen to more Little Said. I met this fine ass hoe, she took me straight to Dennis. Cheap bitch, I like to eat it Friday. We jumped in the NSX, bumping Isley. I had some weed, so I stopped and got a Philly blunt. She said she don't like them blunt, so I rolled a ton. I blew a gun, she was high. You had to know by now that that wasn't all. We always end each season of the VMP Anthology Podcast with a tease of what's coming next. Here is that tease, my friends. Next season of this podcast will finally be the season devoted to Impulse Records. It's going to be pressed at the VMP plant. It's happening. By the time you hear this, it could have already happened and started shipping, but it'll be very soon if not. So, Impulse is the next season of this podcast. The next anthology after Impulse, which also has likely been announced by the time you're listening to this, is the Blue Note repress. It's been 5 years since we did our first edition of the Blue Note anthology. They're having another anniversary. They asked us to be a part of it. We said we'd love to. We want to redesign the box. We've learned a lot about what goes into box design in the years since. So that's the next anthology that you can purchase. You can listen to season one of this podcast from 2019. If you want to hear that season of Blue Note while you're waiting for that box to come from the VMP plant. Now, what's next in anthology? I'm always straight with you people on here, and I like to give hints when I can. We don't know what's next. We have a lot of ideas, but right now it's sort of a rally car race to see what's next. Is it another rap anthology? Maybe. Is it one of the two that we have that we're working on that are devoted to solo women artists? Maybe. Is it a box devoted to one of the greatest songwriters we've ever had, a very underrated cult figure? Maybe. All I know is there will be more VMP anthologies this year, and you will have to wait to see what's next. So, thank you again for being along for the ride. We appreciate you out there. We'll see you soon with Impulse.